Hey, pull up a chair. We're so glad to have you join us here on the Back Porch Education Podcast. For the next half hour or so, we're going to talk about all things educational. It's a wonderful day to learn something. Glad you could join us.
Jason, come in. Yeah. Have a seat. Yeah. Sit down. I am so excited because I want to talk to you for a moment about a bone I have to pick with you. I want you to try and understand from my perspective, as we're in our umpteenth episode now of this podcast, almost every week you come in and what do you have with you?
A poem.
Yeah, you've got a poem.
Yeah.
So every beginning to our podcast, you say, "Hey, Steve, I've got a poem," and I pretend to be surprised, but I assumed that you were going to bring it. And right. You'll ask, "Can I read it?" And I'll give you permission for some strange reason. Even though one of these days I'm just going to say no. And But here's the key: you read your poem, blah 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 blah, and at the end, almost without exception, what do you say?
Don't I say, "Well, what do you think, Steve?"
Exactly. And you throw me out there naked as a jaybird in front of the entire listening audience. And I usually say something like, "Nice." And so today, just for entertainment's sake, I brought a poem. I think it has something to do with what we're talking about today. And I guarantee you that when I'm done reading it, I'm going to say, "Jason, what do you think?" And we can enjoy listening to your pregnant silence for a moment instead of mine.
Perfect.
I'm probably not as well read in poetry as Jason is. So the most prolific poet in my life is a gentleman named Bono, and I have a poem he wrote.
A modern bard.
I have a poem that he wrote. He writes a number of poems that his musical group U2 then puts to music. Summer stretching on the grass, summer dresses pass, in the shade of a willow tree, creeps a crawling over me. Over me and over you, stuck together with God's glue. It's going to get stickier, too. It's been a long, hot summer. Let's get undercover. Don't try too hard to think. Don't think at all. I'm not the only one, staring at the sun, afraid of what you'd find if you took a look inside. Not just deaf and dumb, staring at the sun, not the only one who's happy to go blind. Jason, what do you think?
Oh, okay. Man, I was hoping for some Joshua Tree or something that I knew. I don't know that from Bono. But, okay, so he's talking about the sun. Yeah, that's right in line with what we're talking about. The whole summer thing, okay, going blind, looking at the sun, cool. I'm good with that. What I didn't get, the part of the poem or song or whatever that kind of threw me was his bit about hiding. Get undercover, something about undercover, underground or something? Did he say something
about that?
Let's
get undercover. Don't try too hard to think. Don't think at all.
Yeah, what's up with that? That sounds like totally not Plato. The rest of it, I'm like, okay, cool. But that sort of is like,
well, I don't want to turn this into a music review, but Pop is probably one of their least favorite albums out in the popular world. But it was a project of theirs to just go further with the Octung Baby notion that we're going to make fun of pop culture. They went a lot further and kind of broke out the other side and had disco balls, and they came walking out of a 30-foot lemon and so on and so forth. Yeah. And Staring at the Sun is stuck right in the middle of that album. Mm. And I think is indicative of their notion that man, culture is a mile or miles wide and a half inch deep. And rather than becoming informed by light, most people are just getting hot and sweaty and looking for shelter.
And trying not to think.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, you know, ignorance is bliss, right? Isn't that what?
Sure.
Isn't that a Platonic notion? Certainly.
That's well, that's a pop notion. So kudos to you, too.
We do want to try and start out today to talk about something. Well, actually, to continue talking about something that we brought up last time. We sort of jumped into the Republic as one of the great clearinghouses of educational thought, and admitted that we have a lot of work to do if we're going to try and unpack it, but that really the three analogies that Plato puts into Socrates' mouth, and I can only assume that it's stuff he actually got from Socrates, there was a succession of three analogies to try and help us understand how to live in the truth. How to enjoy the truth. And I think it's an important thing because teachers are ostensibly dealing with the truth and trying to teach. Well, how do you know anything?
Okay.
I think it's useful for us to spend this time talking about a basic subject like how do we know anything? Because we live in a day and time that calls into question the very basis of these three analogies that Plato's going to develop for us. Can we, what is truth, and can we know it, and is it possible to communicate it between ourselves and others? We need students today. We need teachers who are helping students see that though we live in a rapidly changing world, there are truths that can be held on to that aren't changing. And I think Plato's Republic is a great place to work with that. I'm not necessarily suggesting that teachers, I guess it depends on the age of the student, real young students probably don't need to go jumping into Plato. But if a teacher has Plato there behind them, helping them, I think they're gonna find him. These analogies will help them as they shape the minds that they have been asked to teach.
Mm. Yeah, that's good. So right before we go to break, Steve, I want to pick up on something that about what you just said. It's not super on point, but I this is the best place that I'm going to find to throw it in here. You said something about, you know, should the really young be on learning about Plato and that sort of thing. So let's see what Plato has to say about that.
Yeah.
Okay. In book six. This is right before he starts his first analogy. I saw this quote. It's great. So let's throw it out there. Socrates says, in childhood and youth, their study and what philosophy they learn should be suited to their tender years. Right? So he's saying, hey, you don't have to start with the analogy of the cave when they're 4 years old, you know, give them a little time, but recognize that they're training toward something, in the end. So,
right. So it's almost erecting one of those, domino things backwards.
Yeah.
That
right.
The teacher has to have already thought through all this stuff and then find a way to simplify it enough for the youngest minds to grasp it.
Mm-hmm. Which is what Plato does for us here with these three analogies.
Yes, exactly. Hey, during this brief break, I wanted to encourage you to use the share buttons we have on our website in order to help us get folks tuned into the show. Our goal is to encourage as many educators, homeschoolers, NFL punters, and donut makers as we can with these podcasts. So help us get the word out. Share our Facebook page. Send folks a link to one of your favorite episodes.
do whatever you can to help us share this craziness with either your best friends or, if it's more appropriate, your worst enemies. We will love you all the more for sharing our love. Thanks. And now, back to the show.
All right, so let's jump in. Analogy, you even hear this referred to as two different analogies. One is the analogy of being, and the other is the analogy of the sun. Maybe we should just call it Plato's analogy of the sun and not confuse people. But Plato is trying to find a way to – he's already identified for us, and I read the quote, I think, last episode, that the most precious eye we have is the eye of the soul.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like he says it's more precious than 10,000 physical eyes. But we're probably more easily aware of seeing with our physical eyes than understanding how we see with our soul, even though we see with our soul more than we see with our physical eyes. So he's, again, that's the purpose of an analogy. Take something that we know and understand at least better to understand something that's more difficult for us to grasp. And so he uses this, the sun, that star out there that gives us light and warmth and life, and it uses this as an analogy for how we can grasp or see the truth. And it's fairly simplistic, but he basically says to see the truth, we have to have light. We have to have be in a place where the truth could be perceived. And as when we get to the cave, he's going to contend that bright, just like the physical sun, really can't be looked at directly, or you go blind, Bono. We tend to use the light of the sun to understand everything around us, even though none of the things around us are providing the light by which we see them.
Right.
Am I making sense so far?
I think so. Yeah. So for me, like, what's really helpful in understanding this whole thing is the distinction within the analogy that Plato draws between sight as a sense and the other senses. Because what he's going to end up doing is saying that the soul works the same way that the eye works. And the eye works different than all the other senses. With the other senses, when you hear something, there's just the sound and then your ear, and it's a direct receiver, right? Or if your hand touches something, you feel it immediately. So all there is the object and your sort of reception, or you, well, we might say your perception of it. But yeah, with the eye, that's different. It's not the same, because there could be a big scary monster 3 feet in front of my face. But if I'm in the middle of the woods in the middle of the night and it's pitch black, I can't see anything.
You might hear it. You might smell it. You might even run into it. Your senses right. wouldn't fail you there, but the sense of sight is dependent upon this
light.
Yeah, this third entity. There's a triangular relationship here instead of just a back and forth.
Right. And so with the soul, right? If your soul, Socrates is saying, does not directly perceive things as they are. Your soul doesn't work like your ear. Your soul works like your eye, and your eye needs light. So your soul then needs truth.
Okay.
And how do you feel about that one?
Well, so before we move on, there's a couple ways we could get through all of the analogies and then come back to the classroom, or we could stop off at the classroom with each of the analogies. I think our listeners need to understand that we're walking up a staircase here, and that we're ultimately going to get to the most goods when we get to the cave. but you can't get to the cave without the divided line, and you can't get to the divided line before you first have the analogy of the sun. The analogy of the sun is pretty much, it's foundational and fundamental to what we're talking about, but it's sort of like if once you quote unquote see it, there's not a lot that needs explaining if you understand what he's trying to say, that our souls and bodies' eyes behave similarly, and in particular, trying to get a hold of what our soul is doing in education is analogous to looking at a flower being dependent upon some light source. In his day, the only true light source being sun, and I would say even in our day, frankly, I can make an argument that all the artificial light that we have isn't real light. And could go off on that in another direction, I guess, with our Christian beliefs that even the sun isn't as real as the creator of that light, right. God himself. So ready to move on to the divided line?
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. I think you're drawing that sort of drawing our attention to the difference between Socrates' time and ours, where we have so much, like artificial light. It's easy for us to forget how scary it could be and how dark it can be without artificial light, you know? So like you look back at all these, I'm going off on a tangent now, but you look back at all these old Christian hymns that were written before artificial light and, you know, it's huge, right? God as light, God as the dispeller of darkness, right? Like it's all over the place because the difference really is that great, you know? And so I think Socrates is tapping into the same thing here. We've got to have truth to, illuminate, I guess, right? Illuminate what we're perceiving.
And to calm us down. I think you're on a pretty good point.
Yeah.
If you've had young children who suffer from fear of darkness, and you're contemplative about, well, what is this thing? Why is it so compelling to them? Why is it so hard to get them over it? It's because we are uncomfortable in the dark. We don't know. We have to see. We have to understand. And the frustration of being in a society that almost seems like it's using mirrors. You know, I'm reading a fascinating book right now, R.G. Collingwood's The Idea of Nature. And at the front of the book, the basis is that he feels like our very concept of what constitutes nature has, within the last 100 years, changed pretty radically. And he talks about the Greeks believing that reality was in and of itself a living thing, an organism. And Christianity comes along and seeks to help that mature, and unfortunately probably went too far with it, not Orthodox Christianity, but especially the deists and whatnot kind of pushed it from being an organism to a machine, that nature is sort of this big computer, and the Enlightenment moved us into the seat of programmer rather than, I don't think God should be viewed as a programmer, but nowadays
within that model, that's how they understood it.
Right. But notice in both of those paradigms, you could still know something. Whether you were getting to know the Greeks' notion of nature or just becoming a good mechanic that understands how everything there was stability. And Collingwood's point is that nowadays, especially with the evolutionary notion that everything's in a constant state of change or progress, if you want to use that term, nothing can be known permanently. And our children are growing up in a day and an age when many people even Christians, think that truth has to change with the times. And I'm not even arguing that at the moment. I'm trying to look with Plato's eyes at, you know, I used earlier the for his analogy, the analogy of mirrors. If you've ever been in a hall of mirrors, you know, which image is the real image and which ones are reflected. That's all an extension mm-hmm. of what Plato's talking about. There is a real sun and it is providing real light. It can be reflected. Nowadays, we can find ways to God created it to be harnessed by plants.
True.
We're coming along and just recreating what God had already created when we try and harness solar energy. But in particular, the use of it for perception, like you said, it's a whole new world where we can work as well at night as we can during the day.
Mm-hmm.
We used to have to live within the limits of light.
Dude, I feel and some Wendell Berry coming on.
Well, I mean,
it's good.
There's a great movie. Again, Steve Elliott, the great movie reviewer. The Simple Life of Noah Dearborn stars one of my favorite actors, Sidney Poitier, made not too long ago. There's a scene where to get you into the spirit of the thing, Noah Dearborn is a wood craftsman. And nobody really respects him for his choices to stay with hand tools and non-powered tools and that sort of thing. But when a really complex or hard to figure out woodworking problem comes up in town, he's the one they call. So, but as this young lady and her fiance are working on things and become connected with him, and she's trying to figure out Noah Dearborn, and they go to visit him one evening. He lives in the top of a barn, and they get up there and he's got an oil lamp going, and they start talking to him about a project. And he says, "Well, I'll get on that tomorrow. We were hoping you could start tonight." He says, "There's no light." I said, "Well, turn the lights on." He says, "I don't have any lights." "You see those windows over there? Those open up in the morning when the sun is up, and I get up and I work from the light of the sun. I don't have any lights out here." "Well, how do you run your tools?" "My arms. Thank you very much."
Right,
you
know? Right. Yeah.
I'm not even necessarily trying to run down some Luddite path here or how we need to get rid of all electricity or anything. I'm just saying that the distance between our world and Plato's world, a world with only, for the most part, I mean, I know they had fire, but generally speaking, daylight and night, you did different things. And, you know, if you've ever been at a major arena that's well lit for football or basketball or something like that, it's just as bright or brighter than daylight.
Yeah, definitely.
And well after dark. And it's just, you know, it takes a lot of power to do that. But we just live in a different world. And all of this to say, I think our students need to understand truth. If we don't want to frustrate them with jello truth that they can't nail to the wall, but give them something solid to hold on to, then these analogies become pretty important. Hey, during this brief break, I wanted to encourage you to use the share buttons we have on our website in order to help us get folks tuned into the show. Our goal is to encourage as many educators, homeschoolers, NFL punters, and donut makers as we can with these podcasts. So help us get the word out. Share our Facebook page. Send folks a link to one of your favorite episodes. Do whatever you can to help us share this craziness with either your best friends or, if it's more appropriate, your worst enemies. We will love you all the more for sharing our love. Thanks. And now, back to the show.
Okay, guys, so I would like to now talk about the divided line with you, Steve, because, so listeners, what you don't know is before the show started, I asked Steve if he wouldn't mind me introducing the divided line. And the reason that I want to introduce it is pretty clear. I've read The Republic a few times. And every time I read The Republic, I know what's coming right after the divided line. And that's the analogy of the cave. Okay, well, the cave's amazing. Obviously, you want to get to that. And the divided line is kind of hard to understand, especially when you're just reading it in print and don't have some sort of diagram to look at. So typically, I just rush by it. And I don't always understand exactly what's going on, or I hadn't. So going through it today, though, I was forced to slow down and look at it.
Yeah, this time I told him you have to. Slow down.
Yeah, my boss told me I have to. Yeah. So that's what we're going to do. And no, I'm glad I slowed down because it's pretty good stuff. So I'm going to read a little bit, just a little section from Socrates, and we'll see what happens. This is the beginning. This is the setup. Now take a line which has been cut into two unequal parts and divide each of them again in the same proportion. And suppose the two main divisions to answer, one to the visible and the other to the intelligible, and then compare the subdivisions in respect of their clearness and want of clearness. And you will find that the first section in the sphere of the visible consists of images. And by images, I mean in the first place shadows, and in the second place reflections in water and in solid, smooth and polished bodies and the like. Do you understand? Glaucon says, yes, I understand. Jason says, no, I do not understand.
Yeah. Steve says Glaucon is a genius if he got that the first time.
Exactly. I think Socrates had to be drawing something in the dirt to help old Glaucon out. Come on. Okay.
I've always seen him with a stick in his hand when
exactly. Okay, let's back up. Let's try this again. You have a line. Now, when he says a line, what he really means is a segment, because a line goes on forever and you can't have it be unequal. It'd just be infinity on each side. Okay, so you have a segment. You cut it unequally. One side is bigger than the other. Okay, now you cut each of those parts unequally. So they each have a larger and smaller section. Okay, so now you have four parts of a line segment. The smallest, the next biggest, and the biggest. Okay? Each of these, Socrates argues, corresponds to a certain usage or faculty, I think is the word he uses, a certain faculty of the soul. Okay? But let's slow down. The smaller section, actually, Steve, do you know, it doesn't actually say in the text if it's the smaller or the larger of the main two sections, but I think that he's organizing these in terms of the bigger it is, the better.
Yes, yeah.
Okay, cool. So then let's take the smaller section, the smaller main part of the segment. Has to do with the sphere of the visible, things that you can see. The bigger section has to do with the intelligible, things you understand. Okay, so now within each of those, there are clear things and unclear things. Mm-hmm. When it comes to the visible, the unclear things, that would be the smallest line segment. These are the least good, the least important, are reflections. What else, Steve? Do you remember reflections?
Just the images. One I remember.
Yeah, images. Okay. Oh, imagination.
I think pictures and that sort of thing fall in this category. We say it's worth 1,000 words, but it's not. I'm not looking at the real thing. A picture of the Grand Canyon is not the Grand Canyon.
Exactly. Yes. Okay, perfect. So pictures, images, but it's the imagination of the real world, but it's not real stuff.
Right.
Okay. The clear stuff of the visible things is the real world. Animals is what Socrates says. But in your example, Steve, it'd be the Grand Canyon, right?
Right. With me standing there looking at it.
Exactly. Right. You looking at the Grand Canyon, not a photograph of it.
Correct.
Keep that relationship in your head, because that same relationship happens in the realm of the intelligible, the things you do with your brain. Okay.
Yep.
So
yep.
The unclear stuff is what Socrates talks about as hypothetical. But what he's really talking about is a way to understand, right? A way to obtain knowledge. And so he talks about, you know, a square. Now, I might draw a square on the chalkboard, and anybody who looked at it would say, that's not actually a square. I would have to agree with them. It's not actually a perfect square. But I'm not talking about this drawing. I'm talking about the idea of a square.
Right. So if I mentioned to you a door.
Right.
If we're in a room together and I point at the door, we're contemplating that actual visible door.
Right.
But if I talk to you about going through the next door and there's no door around, you and your mind can still conjure up an image of a door without having to see it with your physical eye.
Right. And so if you were sort of counseling me on, you know, what I should do with my life or something, and you say you need to go through the next door, what you're using an object to talk about an idea.
Yep.
Okay. That's what you got to hold on to here.
Yep.
Now, that's good. Fine. That's real knowledge, even Socrates would say. But take it up a notch to the highest understanding or knowledge. And what you have is, as Socrates says, where the soul talks without the aid of any sensible, that is able to be sensed, sensory object, without the aid of any of those, from ideas, through ideas, and in ideas, she, that is the soul, ends. So when you're just up there talking about ideas without the use of objects as reference, that is reason. And that is, Socrates argues, the highest form of knowledge. Yeah. How'd I do, Steve?
Yep. So I know the reaction many people have is, well, if all of this is true, it seems like we can do this without knowing what we're doing. I mean, if we were made to think, then we can just think without thinking about how we think. But I would argue that there's some real benefit to a teacher, someone who's trying to help students know things, in being conscious of what it is that we, yes, all do unconsciously, but we're actually going to get better at it by being conscious about it than if we just kept not thinking about it. Does that make sense?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So, this notion that we move through levels, that there's phases, I don't even know, modes, maybe that's the right term.
Yeah.
States of mind, levels of understanding that you've been talking about.
Well, yeah. Faculties is the word that Jowett, right? The translator, technically uses faculties of the soul.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we get, I love the Greek language because it's so much more particular in many regards than English.
Yeah.
I'm not going to kill our audience with all kinds of Greek terms, but but moving from sort of this visible world of what we perceive you know, when we're working with students, and this is the humbling part of teaching, we're teaching them to see the best that we can see it together.
Mm-hmm.
We're bound by the limitations of both the teacher and the student.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've contemplated, to my benefit, before going into a class, or especially a science classroom — I always used to do this a lot when I was teaching science more often — 1,000 years ago, what were the prevailing dogma of science? And that's a, you know, takes you a little bit to get back there, but it's a,
yeah.
It's almost, we laugh, right?
Sure,
that's pretty much those silly people, flat earth, or, and I could argue against that, but we at least have the notions in our mind. They didn't know anything about electricity. They didn't have Newton's laws. They didn't, forget about Einstein, et cetera, et cetera. They were so limited in what they could see.
Sure.
Didn't have a microscope. Really didn't have much to speak of in the way of telescope.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not going to go and talk about all that the Egyptians and the Greeks did know without the use of those tools, because in some regards they put us to shame, or at least birthed the notions that led us to our high and mighty technological advances. But they were limited to what they could see. And I don't just mean that physically. I mean that in their minds as well. The assumptions they were working off of to build their knowledge was limited by what they had to work with. And so are we. So that's the second part of my little mental gymnastics, is not only 1,000 years ago, what do we laugh at them for? But 1,000 years from now, what are they going to laugh at us about?
Right. Yeah.
And I have to enter the classroom with some humility, recognizing both my physical and my soul's eyes are only so good. And my students, being younger than me, don't, especially the soul's eye, isn't even as well developed as mine. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not only limited by my own relative soul blindness, I have to adhere to the limitations that are present within my young students. And that then brings us, you know, that bright light, right? The mm-hmm. sun. Much of education is us just trying to peer through our split fingers, you know, trying to see the blinding truths that are in many cases much too hard for us to even perceive.
And right.
That's exactly the words that Paul uses when he's brought up into heaven to see sights that words can't even express. He's just like, I, you know, and that's only saying something for the Apostle Paul, because he was a fairly articulate individual.
That's right.
But well beyond his inner perceptiveness, he just couldn't. I can't utter this. I don't know how to put it into words. So mm-hmm. It's fascinating stuff.
Yeah.
To me.
Yeah. I think the other thing that we want to pull sort of out of the divided line for the classroom in particular is just this notion of knowledge being valued, right? Like, and some knowledge is higher and lower, more and less valuable.
Yeah.
That is not uncontested these days, and that's fine. Like, if you don't subscribe to that, whatever. Okay. But it sort of is on you to come up with a theory that is competing with this, but equally compelling or more compelling. And there are a lot of thoughts out there about that, outside the scope of this immediate episode anyway. But if you do buy into that, then that matters, right? Because you're going to, as a teacher, or I would say, actually, you ought to be working the students, the faculties of their soul always, but you ought to be training them to be working those highest faculties of the soul, right? More. That's what we're after.
Right. There's, I guess another way to put it is that there is a way to arrive at meaning. There are numerous theories about what that way is. Whether that's through what Plato is explaining, which Aristotle's going to disagree with to some extent, right? And, you know, philosophy has had any number of viable, serious theories about how we get there. But the teacher has to be thoughtful about what their assumptions are and what are the, what is that route? Because that's your, the blind leading the blind is not education. And that, I guess, is I'm not going to say that's analogous to today's problems, but some of the problems stem from people just not being sure if there's anywhere to lead people. I think there's a serious group of people out there that believe everyone's got to kind of figure that out for themselves. And as a result, the role of teacher has become radically different to where many people want to move away.
We've done it. We've started talking about the cave.
Ha! You led me in there, and I didn't even know, and I couldn't see. I had my sunglasses on.
All right, everybody. Man. Well, we're gonna stop here, and we'll talk about the cave next time.
Well, thanks again for joining us in this great conversation about education. We hope you will not just listen, but participate. Leave us a comment, suggestion, or thought on our website. You just never know when we'll use it on the show. Until next time, pursue joy and learn something.